today we're going to talk about the civility codes, the way locals in the National interact, and I may rib him on the problems of the Democrats and the DSA's relation to them. All right, so what's up?
Hey, well, thanks for having me on again. I really appreciate it. And, you know, it's funny, my my friends were highly amused at hearing me on the first podcast, which came out recently. So that's before I start, I was actually wondering, did you get any interesting reactions to the stuff that I was saying, like people telling me that I'm full of crap, who are other DSAers or people who are non-DSAers expressing surprise? Because, you know, like, obviously – my point of view is very particular, like, you know, so I don't want to act as if I'm like this great authority on the DSA, but, you know, like the but I am wondering how other people kind of took it, because I think that the DSA internally hasn't really been written or spoken much about in public yet. So I was wondering how that kind of resonated with people.
Well, you know, I have a close friend who is a chapter lead in the Tampa DSA, and she had a few things to say about some stuff I mentioned that you said. Mostly that the locals seem really heterogeneous, and it's very hard to generalize from one region to the other. And that New York sort of, the concerns in New York can sort of dominate just because that's sort of ground zero for the DSA right now. And another response I had from an outsider in Canada, a more, you know, a more Marxist purist type like myself, he actually just asked me, "Was he supposed to tell himself that?" You know, like
no, you mean like was it a breach of party discipline? To
yeah, exactly. And I was like, "The DSA isn't a party; you don't have any discipline." Duh, didn't you listen? No.
No, actually, I mean, I really do like that response in particular, because that, to me, is precisely the thing to which the DSA is an antidote in my reckoning. Not to say that there is no use for confidentiality or on certain questions, but I think that its overuse by parties and organizations inspired by the Bolsheviks is definitely a factor in the deterioration of a lot of those organizations. Yeah. I really do think that part of protecting dissent means being able to air opinions and grievances and disagreements in public.
Yeah, the three practices, and they're interesting to me because when you look at the history of the Bolsheviks, they actually all emerge after 1918. They're not actually part of the pre 1917 Bolshevik model.
Of course. No, that's the best part, isn't it? Like, the Bolsheviks in their moments of greatest success are actually not democratic centralists in the, like, cliche kind of kind of model, which is itself, like, a funny thing.
Well, I mean, I've either said democratic centralism is either bureaucratic collectivism or it's redundant.
Right. I think that's exactly right, actually. That's a good slogan.
Because, duh, if we're all voting, you know, that we're centralizing the power, you know, collectively, that's what it means. Or it's some kind of bureaucratic apparatus. I mean, to me, the things that, you know, one of the reasons why I've always been somewhat optimistic about para-party formations and why, like, people... I think a lot of people are confused about, you know, Derek, you hate reformists, so why do you talk to the DSA so much? Well, because they're not really a party, so they're not an openly reformist party either. I mean, I have strong criticisms, we might get to that later, but the bigger and larger issue to me is that there are three practices I see coming out of that post-1918 Bolshevik conception that I think are... they're not just anti-democratic. They tend to destroy party structures. I mean, I'm going to sound like a Bordigas now, which are like, you know, ultra-Leninists, but they said this too, that Bolshevication models kind of cut off the dial. And to people like you, this is going to sound like Marxist jargon, but you know, maybe you'll get what I'm saying. Cut off the dialectics within the party because they, like, remove opposing voices. And what they...
Right, it calcifies the process of evolution by which any organism or social grouping, you know, changes so that it can adapt to changing circumstances.
Exactly.
Or, like, you know, like, I know a thing or two about dialectics, Varn, you know?
Well, yeah, but anarchists get a little sketchy around the D word. I mean, my thing about dialectics is not that I am against it, but that I hear it used in ways where I'm like, do you know what that means? Because I don't think like, magic.
It doesn't mean, you know, I actually have a pet theory, which I can't prove, but it's, and this is of absolutely no interest to anyone, so I'm not even sure whether it's worth voicing, but since you brought up dialectics, so, you know, the Orwellian concept in his satirical books of doublethink, right? Mm-hmm. Like, which is basically just like cognitive dissonance, holding two ideas that are mutually incompatible or even the opposite in your head at the same time, so you can hop between one or the other as is like convenient based on the party line. Right. So obviously this is like a characteristic of Stalinism and the way that, like, you know, yesterday we were, you know, like part of the leading members of the anti-fascist popular front. And then tomorrow we're doing the, like, you know, Hitler Stalin pact or whatever. Right. But the funny thing is that I have a hunch, and I can't prove this, Orwell actually read, when he was hanging around with all these independent labor party people, like a shit ton of Marx, and even like stuff that like most people were not reading at the time, kind of like proto Western Marxist stuff, like a lot of the theses on Feuerbach and that kind of stuff. And I wonder if the ultimate genealogy of doublethink doesn't actually go back to the way that a lot of these little Stalinoid kind of formations and the communist parties would say, in order to justify what Orwell later called doublethink, say, you're not being sufficiently dialectical, comrade, you know, like, you have to understand that blah, 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 blah. And like dialectics as holding two things in your head at the same time, because, you know, you can kind of twist Hegel, right? Like, you know, with the whole bit with like contradictions and stuff and sublation, like, you know, if you just twist it a little, you can turn that into these two things that seem like they're like only one of them can be true. They're actually both true, you know. So right. it's actually kind of like I can't prove this, but I have like a little conspiracy theory that that's where doublethink ultimately comes from.
I was thinking about, of course I'd be thinking about this because it's what I've been studying recently, but Adorno and his talk about everybody, including Hegel, trying to foreshorten or stall the dialectics. And that's, to me, what doublethink actually is, and how dialectics ends up actually being used a lot of times is weirdly like it's like a brain stop that actually stops a dialectical process, like going through an idea, its opposite, and then basically pitting them against each other historically and seeing what comes out the other end is, you know, the vulgar way of explaining what dialectics is. And when you're trying to hold two things in contradiction simultaneously at the same time, and that isn't just true, so as a side note, that isn't just a process true of Stalinism. It was a process explicitly advocated by fascists too.
Right.
I mean, and it was explicit in fascism. Like, Giovanni Gentile actually, you know, said that outright, that you just told the two, you hold the thesis and the synthesis together at the same time. Which is why, like, trying to categorize fascism as modern or anti-modern or any of that becomes almost impossible to do, because there's deliberately conflicting traits. To bring it back to the subject at hand, though, I mean, one of the three practices that I think are, is one, way too much treating things like terrorist cells when you're actually not doing terrorist cell things. Like, there are reasons to have, you know, party discipline and military security in an insurrection, but not when you're trying to, I don't know, recruit people for your cause. It seems, you know, counterproductive and very, very, it makes people very, very nervous, rightfully. Slate voting, which is like the most undemocratic form of democracy.
I mean, it really is. I wouldn't even call it democracy. I think it's literally just like a con act to get rubber stamp votes that seem like they're democracy.
Yeah, and then they're almost like always paired with public ballots, which are all things that, I mean, they did, the Bolsheviks did do them under Lenin. That's why Trotskyist parties still use them, but they didn't do them originally. And that's one of the more interesting things to me. And, you know, if I've been involved in groups and stuff that do that, and that's always been a sign.
Yeah.
because their leadership stultifies. Like the people who set up the cadre, the founders generally stay the slate leaders no matter what.
Exactly, and they tend to be, there's a certain impatience with theorizing process in that tradition too, which also tends to, one of the consequences of that, I think, is the it's who's the one who are setting up the elections and all the different slates, even if there are more than one, it's that leadership slate in the first place too, in the current central committee. So it's kind of like if they're both the overseers of the election and like the sort of dominant, like, you know, incumbent, then that kind of is like, you know, having the wolf monitor the hen's eggs, you know. It's a little
But this is where having a good grasp of systems theory really helps, and also having been through some of these things. So the DSA avoid that. This brings us to civility codes.
You're right. So it's complicated. The DSA has a lot of really interesting things that it's developing, and things is a weird, is a ambiguous word. But it's kind of multifarious, I think. It's like techniques and procedures and sort of like implicit ways of doing things. And I mean, if you want to get really, like, you know, highfalutin about it, forms of life that are really interesting and have a lot of promise insofar as they solve certain problems or address certain discrepancies and failures of historical leftist movements that I think is really exciting. And the one that I want to talk about and put a certain special emphasis on is something that I'm going to write about eventually, but I wanted to kind of like give the broad overview of it now, which is the civility norms. And this doesn't, if you ask a DSAer about quote unquote the civility norms, they may or may not know what you're talking about, because it's not like a thing that people are going around and saying the civility norms. Right. It's a name that I've applied to an emergent set of it's a combination of actual like rules, but also like just kind of like implicit practices that have actually really deeply shaped DSA culture, such that like a great deal of what people like about DSA that they might articulate in like different language or incoherently does actually seem to have a lot of its origins in these things. And it's a really marvelous story. I don't know if you want me to take it from the beginning.
Let's go into that, because I was going to ask you, one of the things I gather is these norms actually slightly vary from region to region and chapter to chapter. But there does seem to be some coherence to them in that sort of like informal formality, which I'll be honest can make me uncomfortable, because they're, you know, I tend to be a tyranny of structurelessness sort of person and distrust rule by chaos or whatever, and also distrust soft norms. But I am interested in the role that it plays, how it is weaponized, how it isn't weaponized. You know, what this can tell us about a socialist sort of culture, et cetera, and so forth. So let's start off at the beginning, and you can tell me what they are and how they developed.
So it begins in the beginning, and this is all – I have this all on oral history. So this is really kind of like an ongoing self-mythologization of the organization. As I understand it, the beginning is a handout. Once upon a time – before there was a modern DSA, and I got into the whole history of the DSA in the last episode that I was on, there was SDS. Not the classical Students for Democratic Society from the 60s that fell apart in 68, but the new SDS that was the attempted revival of the old SDS on college campuses in the early 2000s, the kind of like Iraq war era anti-war movement. One of its groups that was within it was this group of, as I understand it, anarchists and Maoists. Is that accurate?
Yeah, it was. I remember it from the time. They were International Answer was like a weird coalition of like Latin American Stalinist and Trotskyist, and then the new SDS was kind of heavily infiltrated by anarchists and Maoists. Which, you know, I mean, like in the tradition of the SDS, actually is probably historically fair to its tradition anyway. So you know, whatever.
But the interesting thing about it is I was not in this milieu, so I can't tell you much about the specifics of it, but it would appear that the people in it were hyper aware, even the Maoists, it seems, or at least there was some group within it that was hyper aware of the dangers of this kind of, like, apologies to all Maoists out there, very typically Maoist resorting to authoritarian but, like, decentralized forms of, like, mass shaming and public humiliation.
The whole struggle session, which, you know, comes into Maoism after the Cultural Revolution, right? It's not originally part of it, but yes.
Right. And basically this, like, way of, you know, enforcing groupthink, not just through, like, run-of-the-mill kind of social coercion, but literally having this kind of ritualized tearing down of somebody, which, of course, isn't just enforcing groupthink to the extent that you can use it against your enemies or to kind of do these, like, purity purges. You can, of course, move yourself up in your social status in the little activist group, right. And that's how you get these kind of, like, little cults of personality. So it seems that somebody in the old SDS was very, very aware of these sorts of dynamics and had thought about them a lot. Because they, and I have no idea if it was a one person, if it was multiple people, if it was a he or a she or a they or whatever, but whoever these people were developed a handout that had a set of rules, except that they were not rules. It was framed as, like, best practices that for avoiding those kinds of things. And even though it doesn't explicitly mention the struggle session, even though it doesn't explicitly mention Stalinism or authoritarian groupthink or any of these words that I just used to describe those behaviors, it's very clearly, it's almost like a photographic negative. Mm. It was a bunch of best practices developed basically in order to prevent the rising of those kinds of normal behaviors. Because in the same way that those behaviors arise somewhat organically or emergently based on certain social incentive structures, which of course are themselves determined by rules and formal procedures and stuff like that, in the same exact way, this was almost trying to create a different incentive structure that would prevent those things from forming, such that even if you had one bad actor who wanted to create that kind of environment, it would short circuit. And that handout, I don't have the handout as it originally was, but I have it on good authority that the handout that I do have is basically a carbon copy of it. And the reason is that one of those people who was in the SDS of the 2000s, which apparently this was, like, this circulated, whoever made it, it circulated very rapidly in, like, SDS circles, and was used successfully by certain individual sort of, like, campus groups, which tended to be the ones that didn't fall apart as quickly. One of the people who was in one of the groups that used this handout was David Duvalde, who, your listeners probably don't know who David Duvalde is. Any DSAers who are listening know and love David Duvalde. He's one of our longtime staffers in DSA, who is kind of like a little, like, mascot of online DSA, and he's very beloved. He actually is no longer a staffer of DSA. He's still a member, but he actually moved on to another job. The point is, Duvalde, and I don't know, I mean, I presume he was, like, a college person. I don't know the full story, but my understanding from, like, the oral history of DSA is that Duvalde took this handout from, like, the SDS and took it with him, literally, like, a physical copy, took it with him and copied it for DSA later when he joined DSA. And at all the DSA conventions and all the, like, YDS-type conventions, this handout, including the one that I went to in March of 2016 when I joined DSA, I was handed this handout. And it was one of the most impressive things that I had ever seen because I immediately realized what it was responding to. And I was like, oh, wow, if people pay attention to this, this stuff isn't going to happen. And I have a version of it right in front of me, so I can actually read it out loud for you if you want it. It's not very long. It's basically, so I'm getting it here. I don't have the handout. I have what's called a new member handbook, and this is something that individual chapters make. Not all of them make it. It's just that some chapters have made new member handbooks that they put online as PDFs. So I'm shout out to Sacramento DSA. I'm using your new member handbook here. and it's, you know, in PDF form. It's called, this is the handout, it's called The Rules for Respectful Engagement. That's all it is, Rules for Respectful Engagement, DSA Guidelines for Respectful Discussion. Now, this was originally this SDS handout. I don't know how it was modified. I presume that it was modified because, as you'll see, the norm here is that these actually get modified and adapted to changing circumstances, but the core of them has always been the same, and it basically goes like this. Meetings are more productive and more fun when the conversation includes everyone. Respectful discussion guidelines are helpful for keeping things focused, too. You can read these out loud before meetings and forums. We've sometimes asked for volunteers to read each one off. This has been helpful at DSA and YDS meetings, especially when new people are present. We've also shared them with our coalition partners as a useful resource. Now, that's actually exactly true. The way that I was introduced to this was not just that I got the physical handout. It was also that at the beginning of that meeting, as often is really done at the beginning of a lot of DSA meetings where there's new people who are expected to be there, some short abbreviated version of these things are read out loud or pronounced out loud. It's actually more effective if it's just done from memory because it has an almost ritualized quality to it. And it's... You'll hear – I'm interested to hear you ooh and ah at this because a lot of this will make a lot more sense to you because I'm sure that you've heard some of this, Arn. Mm-hmm. One, assume good faith in your fellow comrades. Assume good faith in each other. Please try to speak from experience. Speak for yourself, not for everybody, and actively listen to each other. When someone makes a point, repeat what you heard. Summarize and ask clarifying questions like, oh, did you mean X? Or what makes you say that? To get more information. Encourage yourself and others to maintain a positive attitude. Honor the work of others. Avoid defensiveness. Be open to legitimate critique and challenge oppressive behaviors in ways that help people grow. And sometimes this is presented as a separate thing. And this one, it's kind of folded under assume good faith. It's the call people... call each other in, not call each other out. So we want to call each other in rather than calling each other out. In other words, if you're challenging someone's ideas or behavior, do it respectfully. And if you are being challenged, receive it respectfully. And remember that mistakes will be made because nobody is perfect. And actually, what's interesting is that this doesn't actually use the one that I heard, which is more effective in some ways, is calling in. Also, I've heard it explained as if you're going to explain that something is problematic, don't make it like a big public thing where you like try to publicly shame the person. Instead, approach them afterwards and like talk to them one-on-one and say, hey, you know, this thing that you said actually made me really uncomfortable, and explain why. And generally, that one-on-one approach, it was explained to me, will make things you know, will actually have the effect of changing the person's behavior as opposed to public humiliation, which might actually, like, you know, just lead to its repression, you know, and therefore resentment and blah, 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 which is actually true. I mean, this is actually, like, I've seen this in person, and it works. Or at least it works better, and you can go into the whole social psychology reasons of why it works. So that's like, the whole assume good faith in fellow comrades cluster. Then there's a second cluster, which is know whether you need to step up or step back. Help create a safe and inclusive space for everybody. Please respect others by recognizing how often, how much, and how loud you're speaking, and whether or not you're dominating the conversation. Step back to leave space for others to voice their opinions and feelings if you're somebody who talks a lot. And if the facilitators of the meeting asks you to wrap up, recognize that you should step back. This is especially applies to participants who have privileged backgrounds. But on the other hand, if you're not the sort of person who often speaks up, we encourage you to do so now in this space. And that's like a very simple rule. And I believe that that actually is even older. I believe that that even goes that rule all the way back to like 70s feminism is what I've heard, the step up, step back rule. It definitely comes from somewhere. Like it didn't have its origins in the SDS thing. And it's a wonderful little thing because it's basically like, you know, the old – trot guys will show up at like a meeting and just like start like going on like these like hour-long manifestos in the middle of like a procedural discussion about, I don't know, like the transitional program or something. And like, you know, like there's no way of shutting them up. If you have this kind of rule. You can even just gently invoke it, or even prevent the whole thing from happening because you've invoked it at the beginning. And so they kind of like, if they're conscientious and they're not doing it on purpose, they can kind of like take into account. And then the third one is please ask why I'm talking, which is basically redundant. Or please ask why you're talking if you find yourself talking, so that it's like, you know, meaningful what you say. Please recognize and respect other people's feelings, backgrounds, and cultural differences. Many people have different levels of experience, knowledge, and feelings in social justice and radical activism, and all participants should respect and embrace this diversity. Many people from different backgrounds have different definitions of what it means to be an activist or a radical, and while we don't have to agree on everything, we should respect our diversity of opinions. Recognize that everybody has a piece of the truth. Everybody can learn, and everybody has the ability to teach and share something. Don't use language that's clearly oppressive or hurtful, and please refrain from using acronyms or complicated language that could exclude others. Then there's the one mic rule. Don't interrupt or speak while other people are talking. Respect the facilitator when they choose to use progressive stack, and then they explain what progressive stack is. And last but not least, have a sense of humor. Who said that movement building can't be fun? This is a great opportunity for people to get to know one another, build lasting friendships and relationships, laugh, love, and build a movement. I know, right? It's wholesome. It's wholesome, and this is actually like a really key thing to understanding the whole DSA vibe. But I really want to emphasize the way that if you think of it in almost like a social engineering kind of way, you can see how what's being done here is the establishment of, for lack of a better word, essentially liberal norms of conflict adjudication. Yeah. And this doesn't have to do with, like, you know, the conflict resolution and adjudication, because this doesn't have to do with, like, you know, free markets and parliaments. It's liberal in the specific sense of, like, all the various, like, political technologies that have been developed in order to, like, make it so that you can have people who have opposing points of view coexist in some space together through, like, you know, mutual toleration, basically, and through, like, you know, this kind of, like, inherent valuation of pluralism as a good in and of itself. Now, none of that language is in the rules themselves or the guidelines, because it's right. The other thing, right? It's like, they're not rules. They're, like, these things that are, like, best practices that, like, we should do because we should. And it's not like they're, like, negative rules. They're positive prescriptions.
But they do – I'm going to push back a little bit, because I – I'm with you, particularly in the first three, but as you get into them, they actually have ideological assumptions built into them.
Well, of course they do.
And not all of them are going to be... I mean, to be frank, I don't think they're all socialist.
No, I mean, there's definitely, like, room to argue, I agree. And the other thing, too, is that a lot of these vary, right? So, like, the ones that are most common are... assume good faith in comrades, step up, step back.
Are really, really important, actually, completely.
Yeah. And the basic idea of, like, call in, not call out. It doesn't always get called that, but, like, that basic chunk. So those are, like, the three main ones. And then everything else is, like, kind of, like, ancillary. But progressive stack is common. I mean, it's usually not part of the civility norms, but, like, it's kind of, like, you know, a thing that is done, too. So this is, like I said, it's one version of them. And I got a version of this handout, too. And it's, like, a talk, especially those three rules at the start. Are, like, the things that are most common for people to say at the start of a DSA meeting. And I can actually show you a second version that – I mean, we're not going to go through the whole thing, obviously, but just, like, to give you a sense, I helped to co-write a version of the civility norms for a space that's online that's used – it's a left book group, but that is intentionally trying to avoid the sort of travails of the old dank meme stash that used to exist that basically got – it was a mess. It got – like, there was a whole bunch of, like, tankies who came in, and there was a whole bunch of drama, and it was just, like, it wasn't successful in this way. So we actually, like, one of the ways that we kind of structured the new thing on the group of mods was that we actually integrated the civility norms into it, and it's actually been a huge success. And so just to give you, like, an idea, there's, like – the out-and-out discussion rules, but then there's, like, the suggestions, which is basically the civility norms. It's the same thing. Assume good faith in your comrades. We're a community of comrades. Please try to assume good faith in each other, blah, 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 blah. Call in, don't call out. Step up, step back. Recognize difference. We all arrived. So this is a slightly different articulation of one of the later ones. We all arrived at democratic socialism by different paths. We have different levels of political experience and knowledge, different cultural backgrounds, different class positions of origin, different gender, sexual, and racial identities. As such, we often have different ideas of what it means to be an activist or a radical, and even different conceptions of democratic socialism. This isn't a bad thing unless we turn it into a problem. The DSA is a multi-tenancy organization committed to pluralism and freedom of thought as the basis of a shared socialist commonwealth and radical democracy. We draw strength from our diversity in all its forms when we recognize that everyone has a piece of the truth, everyone can learn, everybody has the ability to teach and share something. And then, like, other stuff that's relevant to the group, like cite your sources and political education, is mutual aid. So, like, that's the kind of sense of how it can be adapted in different ways to different contexts. But a lot of these things, and I'll just close on this because I know I've been talking for a while, but one of the things that is the unexpected consequences of this handout, because really it was a handout and a little spiel that was given at the start of, like, YDS, like Young Democratic Socialists, like semi-annual conferences, right? Like, one of the unintended emergent characteristics that was taken up was that this language actually began to infuse the ordinary day-to-day language of DSAers in DSA spaces. And so, like, one of the important things to understand about these norms is that they're not just, like, these handouts, but the handouts kind of gained a life of their own and began to be orally transmitted through practices like, if I'm sitting at a bar in, like, an after DSA event and I'm complaining about the Jacobins, like, oh, the Jacobins are doing this, that, and the other thing, and it ticks me off so much, blah, 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 like, and I'm just, like, you know, complaining to a DSA comrade, they'll kind of, like, be like, well, I mean, I don't know, you're making it sound like it's like this whole conspiracy. I mean, you have to assume good faith in comrades, right? Like, you have to, and it's just like, it's weird to hear it quoted back to you like that when, like, you know, maybe you had even been the person who did it at the beginning of the meeting, because it becomes essentially this kind of, like, part of a shared morality and a shared moral language. I would even go so far as to call it a shared culture. And of course, the first thing about culture is that it gets appropriated. Quite contrary to the cultural appropriation people, culture is appropriation. It basically can't happen without appropriation. So, you know, like one of the funny things that happens is that, of course, it gets manipulated. And so in a social space where, like, say, you're criticizing the leadership in a more, let's say, less democratic chapter, you know, one of the tricks that the leadership can do is, of course, that they can say that the people who are complaining are making really uncomradely accusations, you know, and are doing this kind of thing. They're not assuming good faith in comrades. They're either acting in bad faith or they're assuming bad faith on the part of the people that they're accusing, when in fact, you know, we're all socialists, blah, 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 blah. But the thing, so obviously there's this way in which you can take these things because they're a shared culture, because people identify with them, and you can twist them, just like you can twist anything in culture to mean its opposite. But the brilliant thing is that it also gives you a language by which to make essentially moral arguments within a DSA space against stuff like that. So it's you know, by virtue of becoming culture, it essentially also becomes a battleground that can be contested, you know, in order to, I mean, I would say in order to encourage either oligarchy or democracy, or in order to, like, you know, adjudicate disputes. So it kind of, like, jumps up from being just this small conflict resolution mechanism into itself being kind of like the cultural terrain on which those battles are fought. So it's very interesting. And I guess my point in bringing it up is that it's very difficult to understand the behavior and the attitudes of a lot of DSAers without kind of having a sense of those, broadly speaking, civility norms. And it's also kind of really interesting, unexpected, unplanned, and as yet untheorized, although this is my kind of stab at theorizing it, emergent quality of the creation of DSA, which is, yes, it's like a proto-party organization as much as some people want to turn it into a party, but what it is, regardless of what people want it to be, what it is because it is what it does, is essentially a like small mini society within society. And of course not so small, because now we're at like 30,000 or whatever it is, but you know, like large enough that it basically is like a culture unto itself with its own kind of like emergent norms and behaviors and morals and even cultural artifacts, that then people can like become part of it. And it's almost like, and I don't want to exaggerate this, but to the extent that it's true, it's a very powerful feeling that sometimes is overwhelming for people who join. It does kind of feel like a little pocket of what a future socialist society could feel like. Like, and I don't want to exaggerate that point, because obviously it's an organization that does things out in the world and does actually quite a lot of things. But to the extent that its internal politics and culture assumes these kind of like weird emergent social totality type qualities, like it actually does kind of feel like a socialist society, in as much as like it has the diversity and the messy democracy and the contestedness and the cultural kind of characteristics of what a socialist democracy itself probably would look like if we were able to pull off like a pluralistic socialist commonwealth on like a national or regional level. So it's very, very interesting. And I know that this is, you made fun of me a little bit last time for doing this kind of like ethnography of the DSA, but I think that if you do want to understand it, you kind of do have to do that sort of thing. And it's very, very fascinating. And who knows what it could become? I mean, it could fall apart tomorrow. Who knows? But it's a very interesting little experiment to me, which is part of the reason why I'm a part of it.
Okay.
Well, maybe you said that you disagreed.
Yeah, prefiguration makes my eyes glaze over.
Of course.
I think civility norms are, I think the big three civility norms are important in that: assume comrades have good faith, assume that people in the organization want to be there, and know when to shut up. These are important. That said, a lot of the language around them is therapeutic, and I think to get into it a little bit, these are still pretty easily weaponized if we have to assume certain things about the nature of angry speech and all that, the way that is handled in a situation. Because I personally find therapeutic culture stultifying, and I think a lot of proles do. I also think a lot of people are tired, fundamentally tired, of ego battles in socialist movements, of the inability to maintain any sort of pluralism, which is a huge problem. But some of the things that people are going to be hurt by are going to be things that, frankly, they're not debatable points. I mean, they are debatable. Let me rephrase that. But they're not points that you should just concede. And we all have our issues on that. And those, and what we have to, and why I both am attracted to this, but also like, there's a lot of therapy language in it, is that I don't think political projects are fundamentally about self-help. And I actually don't necessarily think we know what this would build in our future society. Say we have a socialism, whatever, however we define that. We don't know what those social conflicts are actually going to be. So like modeling things now in a kind of current contemporary conflict resolution way may be helpful for that, but it may also be completely disarming. Disarming for things that are going to emerge later on. And I think about certain trends in and certain misunderstandings in socialism. So, for example, the language of these civility norms could easily be co-opted to the self-care model of left politics. And having seen both the... I'm trying to not use dude-driven language, but it is actually very dude-driven. But having seen the ego clashes and bravado wars of, say, left book, mean status,
and not to mention,
whatever.
And not to mention the bullying and the authoritarianism.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of that.
Using the, like, self-victimization, self-help language.
Well, yeah, this is interesting. This is what I worry about, because it's easy to twist this around, but its fundamental purpose seems to be to cut off content culture and victimization as a source of power, because unfortunately, or fortunately, or whatever, I think it's actually unfortunate, to be frank, and for reasons that I don't even think are moral. There's a huge issue with the way we sort of treat victimization as a means of empowerment on the left. Like, it itself has seen its route to empowerment. You even see it in the way we talk about, like, I don't know, school shootings. It's not only not the point. I mean, like, from my perspective as a Marxist, it's really much not the point that the proletariat isn't important because they're victimized. That's actually, like, it's wrong because they're victimized. That's true. But that's not why that we viewed them as a subject of history. Like, that wasn't...
Not to mention that, you know, the point is not to wallow in your victimhood. It's to abolish the category which produces the exploitation.
Right, exactly. I mean, and the oppression and whatever. And the other thing that really calls on you to do, and this is where maybe I'm going through the dialectic of the civility norms in my head as I talk to you, because I seem like I'm arguing both sides, and not, but and I kind of am, because in another sense, we do have to realize that a lot of who we are, the social baggage that we bring to a socialist group, it's going to be very uncomfortable to cut that out from under ourselves. I mean, you know, one of the things that I always talk about it, you know, and it's been an argument I've had with DSA members in particular, but not just them, is the argument about workerism, you know, and like talking about proletariat as us, or, you know, or whatever, when we aren't doing it, like when I'm not being a worker in that particular point, or when I'm a professor, or when I'm a podcaster, or whatever, which are kind of petty bourgeois things. And I don't think that's necessarily a strike against them. I mean, like, if you look at the leadership of every socialist movement, you know, including the First International, very few of those people came out of the working class, including Marx and Engels didn't. I mean, you know. So you got some... If you both have a workerist point of view and a hagiography of Marx and Engels, you have some mental... some mental gymnastics to do, right? But that's always
how human beings in general, like, confront fundamental empirical challenges to their like organizing worldview, right? Is like, I mean, the first instinct is just to ignore it.
Well, yeah, but I guess this gets to the point I'm trying to get to. All this stuff is great, but the therapy language cannot just be a means of power; it can be a means of not confronting yourself.
Yes, I agree.
So how do we instill the space for self-abnegating or self-negating conflict within a socialist movement? Because I actually think that's not just a little bit necessary, it's completely necessary.
Well, it's a very... All the questions that you're asking are important, and each of them almost requires its own discussion. It's a very complicated question. To the point of... Just to start somewhere, the civility norms being able to be weaponized, I mean, I gave you one very easy example of that, of course. But the thing I think that has to be understood about them is that because part of the, and again, I actually have no idea who engineered these or what was going through their head. I don't even know if I had them in this room, that committee or that individual, would be able to articulate the way that I'm going to articulate in a very abstract way what I think these rules are doing, which almost to me, I would almost bet that they couldn't, which is part of their power for me, is because I think that like what these rules are really doing is that they're trying to basically instantiate through the creation of a certain set of repeated replicable practices pluralism as a norm and a good in and of itself that is protected. And because of that specific element of it, the pluralistic element, which is, yes, I mean, I would argue that's not an idea that's socialist in origin. I think it's socialist, but it's not socialist in origin. It's a liberal idea. And I think that that's actually exactly what these rules are doing. And that is, to the extent that they are that, they give us a weapon by which to fight back against the tendency that exists towards authoritarianism and cultishness and groupthink in political organizations of the left. It doesn't mean that we'll actually win the fight. It's just a tool that you can use in the fight. And it turns out that by using this tool, DSA has been able so far to retain a far wider range of acceptable political opinion within the bounds of what is basically still radical politics, at least by my measure, than any other organization that I've ever seen on the radical left. I would make that claim very strongly. Now, mind you, I'm only talking about my perspective. Maybe there's like a wonderful organization that has done the same thing somewhere else. But from what I've seen and from what I've read about, basically the earliest organization that I can think of that did the same kind of thing, where Marxists and anarchists coexisted within the same organization and even had certain bonds of greater loyalty to the organization that, like, you know, that that superseded their ideological differences to an extent. That basically you would have to go back to the old Socialist Party of America and the First International for that. And of course, that, you know, the cautionary tale here is that both of those fell apart. So one of the things that I tell DSAers all the time is go back to those two parties, or those two organizations rather, because the First International is not a party, and look at how they fell apart, because that'll tell you the whole story of what we have to avoid. Because to the extent that we're aspirationally like that, we have similar internal dynamics, but we're just smaller. That's also what you have to look out for. And I said I used SDS as a comparison before, but I think that, like, in this specific sense of the like pluralism within a range that is still radical, that specific element I think goes back to those two. Now, in terms of the therapeutic language, first of all, could you? I know you and how you talk a little bit, so I kind of have a sense, but could you just to clarify what you mean by therapeutic really quick?
Well, there's a whole lot of stuff about, we all cover different backgrounds, hurtfulness, blah, blah, blah. And I don't mean that in, you know, that to me is therapy language. Like, not the different backgrounds part, but the way we have to, we come to things as individuals and we can, and I think it's in some senses psychologically necessary, but I also, like I've said many times, I don't actually think that these ways of psychologically and morally categorizing things they're not easy to deal with, because they come with a set of baggage that's actually baggage beyond the scope of a political movement.
And I mean, I do think that that's actually a very wise thing to think, right? Because it's like, socialism isn't going to make you not a fuck-up.
Right. Like, and like, if you come, and here, this is what I'm kind of getting to. If you come to socialism like you come to, I don't know, a meditation group, like, or whatever, and you're looking for it as an outlet to reduce your immediate alienation, it's fucking dangerous.
Like, yeah, it's a very interesting. I think that you have your finger on something really important, and it's precisely because I think you have your finger on something important and like respect your opinion on it that I think I can say quite confidently that I, to an extent, disagree.
Okay, let's go.
because here's my take. What you call the therapeutic is extremely dangerous. To your point, it can be basically that's what cults are made of, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, like the reason why people come to cults is because they seem like they're going to fill up some gap that exists in their life, and they get sucked up into them, and cult leaders are able to basically feed off of the anxieties and the alienation and the feelings of loneliness and lack of community and lack of purpose in life that drive people into them in the first place, and basically use that to consolidate their cult of personality and make people do horrible, insane things. Arguably, one of the best essays that was ever written about Hitler, in my opinion, was Kenneth Burke's essay, the great literary theorist and translator of The Death in Venice, and also just like a wonderful critic. He wrote for The Dial, which was one of the great modernist little magazines. And Kenneth Burke wrote probably the best review of Mein Kampf ever to appear in English. And in it, he basically says that what fascism does, and what Hitler in particular in his rhetoric does to stir people up to that, is very similar to what I just described with the cult leader. So everything, like, to the extent that you're basically like putting tentacles inside people's souls, or trying to, and sort of manipulating their hopes and dreams on a personal level, of like fixing themselves or fixing their lives, then you're in very dangerous territory that allows, like, you know, charismatic sort of like leader figures to do all sorts of horrible things. But, and this is my point of disagreement, I can concede all of that and still believe that the therapeutic is basically what you call the therapeutic is essentially a necessary but insufficient condition to a radical politics. Because I think we didn't expand on this point, but maybe now is the time, I think, to go back to it. Last time we said that we were going to expand on the point that you made, that in a lot of ways the demographics for something like the DSA, and I would argue the radical post-Occupy left in general, is very similar to the demographics for the alt-right in terms of these like downwardly mobile professional managerial class kids whose future was taken away from them, who, you know, like basically were like promised a certain way of living and didn't get it, and who like inherit a society that is becoming fundamentally you know, just illegitimate in the eyes of anybody who pays attention, because the political system seems totally corrupt. It doesn't deliver on any of its promises. Like, there doesn't seem to be much of a future. All of that, and then, of course, on the individual level, that tends to manifest itself through one or the other sort of, like, dead end that you reach. Now, I actually think that what I just described is essentially, like, what people like Marx talk about when they talk about material conditions, and what it means for ideological superstructure to emerge from material conditions, in my perhaps heterodox reading of Marx, is precisely that people who are thrust out of their own, like not out of their own choice, but simply by circumstance, into that world that is shaped by those incentive structures and those social structures and institutions or whatever, have to then create stories. And there's usually more than one floating around at the same time about why things are the way they are and how you can fix them. And they are especially motivated to generate new kinds of stories rather than just like listen to the ones that they're told when their own lives are fucked up as a result of those underlying material conditions. And this is precisely where I think you can't avoid the therapeutic, even if you want to, because what people are looking for, what drives people to the left or to the far right now, is actually those conditions of their own lives. And like not just the material conditions in the abstract, but how they affect their own lives, their own prospects, their own happiness. And what people are looking for is, and I don't think that it can be helped, what people are looking for is answers and a sense of meaning and a sense of community. I mean, consider the insane statistic that people lose all their friends within like 10 years of exiting college. Like in almost unanimously, and it doesn't even matter that marriage rates are down. Like consider that statistic. That's utterly insane. It's utterly insane that we live in a society of the sort that's described in that famous sociology book, Bowling Alone, where there really are like no communitarian institutions. So it's very difficult to meet new people. It's very difficult to have a sense of like belonging to something greater than yourself outside of your immediate like kinship unit. And that's something that it seems like human beings need functionally in order to survive or have like a decent life. It's an important ingredient. Like that is actually something that when people join, for instance, even I would argue when they join like one of these like far right internet forums and they find a bunch of like-minded people they can talk to and who aren't like, you know, like, and they can meet new people through it. And I think DSA is especially good example of it because it's like you can actually go and meet new people through it, make actual friendships through it, maybe even like, you know, I mean, I hate to get sentimental, but even like fall in love with someone, you know, and get married and the whole thing. And it's not, I know of no cases personally yet of that happening, but I'm sure that given enough time it will. You know, like, because it's basically in the way that, like, a church is a community that you can be a part of voluntarily through a free association, like, DSA is that. And even though it's a political organization with goals and with, like, the attempt to shape the world in a certain way and blah, 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 in the absence of all those other things, part of the reason why it's so attractive is precisely that it provides people with that sense of community that had been missing in their lives. And there's a whole lot else that it provides people with. And that's actually a great deal of when I was talking about like its culture, like the shared culture that unexpectedly emerged from these sorts of things and the weird kind of like morality that seems to be emerging out of this. Like, I think part of the reason that it emerges unexpectedly from something as simple as a handout is precisely that it is basically the spontaneous creation of that story of what the world, why the world is the way that it is and what we can do to fix it that would also help fix our own lives. That's why you were attracted to it in the first place. And unfortunately, I agree with you. I actually agree that that's a very dangerous thing because it can be turned into essentially what Orwell in Animal Farm very famously calls Sugar Candy Mountain. The idea right. of like, you know, basically like a heaven on earth type deal. And I'm very unsatisfied personally with this kind of like talk of like fully automated luxury communism, a world without work where the robots do all the work and we all just do whatever the hell we want. I actually don't even like it in its less vulgar form in Marx, to be perfectly honest, because I do think that he mystifies the higher form of communism somewhat. I don't think it's that mystical. And I also don't necessarily even agree with Marx's idea of what like the ideal social society would be like, and again,
in so much that it's ever that stated anywhere.
As much as from what I can kind of deduce from certain things that he said, I'm not even sure that I agree with what's in the vague outlines of his.
It's funny because I was thinking about this. Maybe this is where this is another difference in thinking patterns that overlap between us. But people have noticed before that I am apathetic about communism, that I refuse to ever say exactly what it is, even though, you know, there are perfectly good reasons to distrust that. I mean, Trotskyist orgs do that, and Maoist orgs do that, and there are all kinds of orgs, you know, I mean, like, I mean, I think about the most really violent Maoist orgs that were doing it in ways that, like, there was, like, a thousand-year eschatology attached to it. And
absolutely.
And, like, when I was thinking about Camus, who I normally don't take very seriously, talking about the secularization of the eschatology is actually more dangerous than just religious eschatology is. And I was like, yeah, in those cases, it's completely true. So
I agree.
I'm warning against my own tendency, but I also define all this negatively. Like, so,
I mean, one of the things that I think is very clear. I was raised Catholic, rabid atheist now, of course, but I was raised Catholic, and I actually went to a Catholic school where I was taught my religious history and my theology and stuff like that. And you seem to have a healthy interest in the history of religion as well. And one of the things that comes up if you're interested even moderately in the history of, like, you know, at least the Christian religion, although a lot of organized religions follow a similar pattern, and you look at Marxism, I mean, like, one of the things that comes up is that there's a lot of kind of, like, isomorphisms. Like, there's that secularization of the eschatology. I think who was the neocon who famously said immanentize the eschaton? Who was that? Was that Kolakowski?
No, it's Vogelin. Although Kolakowski uses it. I mean, the thing about Kolakowski is Kolakowski, I wouldn't call him a neocon. I would just call him weird. But because his historical moment was wrong for that. But somebody told me the best description of him was Stalinist anti-communism. that part of why he was an that, you know, he really did think it was all Stalinism all the way down, and so, like,
he really did. He took the MLs very literally in their interpretations. Yeah, like, I mean, they're absolutely right.
And he traces it back all the way to Plotinus.
Like, yeah. Plotinus. The problem began with that son of a bitch, Plotinus.
Like,
he
Neoplatonism fucked us up.
It was he who was the bureaucratic apparatchik all along.
Yeah, it's just like
mystical union with the one. That's what really got us.
Yeah, the moment we had Neoplatonism, we were doomed. I was just like, damn, dude.
Kolakowski's so much fun.
You know, that's harsher than Nietzsche. Then he ends up, like, being pro-Catholic, even though he's an atheist. You know, Kolakowski's a weirdo. But
Right.
But it's interesting you bring it up, though. As Kuhnlein and Vogelin are Eric Vogelin, who's a proto, he is kind of a proto neocon about imitizing the eschaton. But interestingly, also, even though Nietzsche doesn't seem to have read Marx and didn't seem to know of Marx at all, but he did know a socialist, and he accused the socialists of the same thing. You know, I've actually come to, and Habermas, interestingly, just actually says Nietzsche's right. We should just, like, own up to it. And I'm like, ah, God, no.
Well, I don't know. Maybe I'm the wrong person to talk to, because I'm actually a bit of a Nietzschean myself too. So
no, I am. The idea that this sort of Benjaminian idea that it's not just that it's a good thing that we're taking the messianic calling just makes me, like,
well, yeah, ugh. No, it should.
It makes me uncomfortable.
It should. No, that's the thing. That's the thing that why even though I say I disagree, almost pretty much everything that you say is true. Like, yes, it should give you chills down your spine, because part of what allowed Stalinism to be such a disgusting and horrific system in terms of its consequences was precisely the fact that it was able to channel this messianism, which I would even argue was necessary to an extent in the workers' movement to achieve the kind of transformations that it needed to do of society and human life, into essentially a despotism that tried to inject itself more deeply into human consciousness than even a lot of the most, like, rapacious despotisms of the past.
Right. But I mean,
at least, and, I mean, it's more complicated than
historical
than that,
dialectic, but... again, and I'm going to speak dialectic, speak to your fans who might get annoyed with me. But I mean, like, look at Russia and China to a lesser degree. China's more of a divided and uneven and frankly weird scenario. And even though I've been exposed to it, worked with Chinese people, you know, been to China several times, I feel very, and know its history actually really well, I feel very uncomfortable commenting about it. Like, right now, in particular, because I don't know that I have a grasp of what's going on. But with Russia, and with a lot of the Soviet Union, but particularly the more you get to the epicenter of the Bolsheviks, like, ironically, like, the looser, goosier, you know, edge of the Soviet world, when the Soviet Union collapsed, they didn't fall back into, like, obscurantist reactionaryism, you know, but Russia's ground zero for that. And right. I've said this for years. I mean, it's this weird thing. And this is Alexander Dugin, you know, the arch reactionary that all the liberals have discovered. Ironically, now that he's not that important in Russia,
right?
But they don't know that. he said it was one of the ironies of communism is that a true pre-modern form of life was actually has been re-emerged from it. And so if you look at it as a dialectical movement, not only does it collapse it into its into almost its opposite thing.
Right, and can contain the germ of it within itself in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm.
And there's some continuity to that. I mean, there are liberal studies that I've taken seriously that there were also still like things unique to Tsarist Russian culture that were maintained in the Soviet period, despite the Soviets, not because they were trying to, but they were actually trying to eradicate it. And you see similar things, and I will say this more on confident ground, China's reemergence of Confucianism seems to be very much tied to this, even though the Maoists who now prop the Confucius Institute are the same people that whose fathers literally tried to eradicate it, you know, to the ground.
Which itself could almost be seen, if you want to be really naughty about it, you could also see that itself as an echo of like the Qin Emperor, the famous burning of the books on the scholars.
Well, yeah, I mean, and Mao did get this in later life, even though, I mean, Mao's a fascinating character when you read his biography, particularly if you read a good Russian one, not an American one. But the Russian archival footage on him is fascinating because what I learned from that is he was actually, you know, for all his talk of anti-liberalism in a lot of ways, he was actually declassé and extremely liberal and even influenced by Nietzsche indirectly, not directly, but through a lot of people in addition to the Russian anarchist communism because it was more common.
And he probably got that. My guess would be that he also got that Nietzschean influence through anarchism, since Mao was also heavily influenced by anarchists.
It was a double strain. So he got it from a sort of right liberal that he studied in his first university years, and then also in anarchism. And Marxism for Mao, I mean, Mao studies Marx in like a reverse Easter egg, where like he reads Stalin first, then Lenin, then Engels, and then Marx, from what I can tell. Like, and that's at the very end of his life. Anyway, my point about all that is one of the fascinations Mao gets when you make up that comparison is that he also started becoming very interested in the legalist. You know, and that's exactly, I mean, like, it was explicit towards the end of his life. So the Chinese legalism and the burning of the books and all that was actually explicitly incorporated into his thinking in the late 50s, early 60s. And so, yeah, it's there. And I mean, it's also an irony of like the Cultural Revolution and this whole, you know, and in a way, some of the very things these civilian norms are meant to cut out. And let me tell you what I mean by that. The Cultural Revolution's death toll comes is high, but it's high actually not from executions. The Chinese, the CCP, the CCP actually was not big on executing comrades.
I mean, they were more into re-education.
Yeah, I mean, they did, you know, like what happened to Li Shaoqi is, Li Shuqi is shameful, but, you know, and that was an indirect execution. But the death toll was larger from Confucian-influenced suicide.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And even, I mean, I wouldn't even be culturally specific about it. I can understand why I would commit suicide after being publicly humiliated among hundreds of people who I consider to be part of my community and then basically shunned. I actually think that that's not even a culturally specific thing.
No.
Community is such an important part of who we are that if you really, like, believe in it and that anchors you and that happens to you, like, I could see it.
But I agree with you. I think it's totally normal. But I also have this theory that I can't prove because no one does good stats on this. No one's like taking activist suicides and categorizing them. But that tendency is actually why at least famous leftists have a pretty high suicide rate.
I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah. And that's. Do you mind if I pivot slightly back to the to get back to our scenario? Because, you know, once history happens, nothing ever dies in history, but it is kind of can't be changed.
Yeah.
People do. People do. Ideas don't. It all just gets absorbed by the dialectic and regurgitated and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But you know, like the in terms of the present, it seems to me that the liberal – ideology, myth, whatever you want to call it, that undergirded the sort of like, you know, American hegemony in global power politics and the kind of post-war economic integration, like, you know, in terms of economics. I think basically like if those are like the sort of like material base of it, and the ideology was basically all the little neoliberal fables, right? Like Fukuyama's End of History, the essentially like Panglossian "we live in the best of all possible worlds" type attitude. All the other ideologies have failed, so therefore you've got developed countries that are already what civilization is going to be from now on, and the developing ones that are just, you know, taking little slow steps to get there. That whole story, along with the other kind of attendant stories and objectives of neoliberalism domestically in terms of like the infusion of market processes into every aspect of life and the transformation of people into consumers rather than seeing themselves as citizens or member of like a ethnic group or as workers or whatever, like all that stuff to me is dead. It's alive, but it's a zombie. Like I honestly, and I know that like it's always kind of like you're biased by your position and all this stuff, but I find it very difficult nowadays, especially, to find a lot of people who are paying even a little, the slightest bit of attention to what's going on, and really truly believe any of those stories anymore. They might sort of, in the way that someone who's in the process of losing their faith, regurgitate some of the slogans, you know, out loud in order to comfort themselves, but even then you can hear the quiver of doubt in their voices. And I do think that even the ruling class, that literally their whole political legitimacy is rooted in this, basically like very cynically uses them to hold on to power, usually through just like sheer violence rather than like actually making people believe in this vision anymore. Now, that doesn't mean that the overthrow of capitalism is imminent and it's going to happen tomorrow. It doesn't even mean that like whatever's going to happen is going to be good. I think that there's like probably an 80% chance at least that it's going to be bad, at least from my point of view and my system of values. But the point is that we're in a period, I think, of major change where the animating sort of like stories that make people structure their own lives are changing because the underlying material conditions that undergird all of the stories that we tell ourselves to sleep at night are changing. And I think that in that context, it is irresponsible, dangerous as it is for all the reasons that we've talked about, not to see, as a political movement, part of your duty to be the creation of a story, and not just you, not some central committee, but the whole culture of the whole movement itself. You know, and if you want to get poetic about it, the real movement, not just an organization, not just like, you know, a party, but the actual kind of like emergent movement that society itself generates through the course of its transformations. Like, you know, the part of the duty of that movement is to provide people with a version of that story that carries forward the torch of egalitarianism and decency and radical democracy, and that story should actually be an animating story in people's lives. Now, there's a lot of people who will say this is idealism, this is very fluffy, blah 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 blah. But I'm saying to you and to the people who are listening that this is already happening, whether we want it to or not. These stories are being generated, and, you know, at most what we can do is nudge them in one direction or another so that they hopefully don't turn into precisely the kind of therapy cults that lead to things like the Cultural Revolution. Because the fascists are also in the process of generating these stories. And people like the Atomwaffen terrorists who are going around and like literally have already killed like, what was it, like a dozen people or whatever, like literally having, like, I'm not one of these people who likes the word terrorist, because obviously the government uses it to just like, you know, deprive people of civil rights who they don't like. But, you know, if terrorism as a political tactic means anything, it means like blowing up civilians in order to make a political point. And the, like, literally there's camps training people right now to do that, run by these kind of like far right types. And if you look at them, they are really true believers in stuff like the impossibility of a multicultural society because of the biological reality of races and the supremacy of like the, you know, of the white race over other races, and the fact that like it's inevitable that we will have this racial tribalism and it'll overcome all of our other group identities. And, like, the whole sexist, misogynist story of, like, you know, the superiority of men and the necessity of patriarchy, that if patriarchy didn't exist, you would need to invent it and reinvent it over and over again because that's just how societies function. And if you get rid of it, societies don't function anymore. All these kind of sophisticated stories, they really believe the stuff, and their lives are being shaped. And I would argue that a death cult like Adam Waffen is precisely the result of the people really truly believing those kinds of stories. And I am a Marxist in as much as I believe that those stories aren't just stuff that people invented. They are the direct result of a particular attempt to rationalize, like, material conditions that, you know, a lot of these people have found themselves in, such as, for instance, like chronic underemployment, or such as, like, you know, their downwardly mobile status within, like, the elite class, part of class society that they were originally born into, or the evaporation of certain opportunities that they might have had before or thought that they were entitled to based on the stories that they had received previously. But either way, these bullshit stories are being invented to create cults of death. Now, I would argue that equally bullshit and dangerous stories that promote cults of death are also being generated as we speak on the Stalinist parts of left-wing Twitter that we like to make fun of. And they're not – they don't have organizational forms yet. They don't have sort of like the ability to actually impose themselves in the world quite – so much yet, but those are very dangerous type stories too. And if there is any hope, it really has to be it's very dangerous, because, you know, what I'm going to say right now is going to sound to some people like it's like the creation of the new man. I don't believe in the creation of the new man. I think that people are people. People have always been people, and people will always be people, more or less. You know, and like, you're never going to have a perfectible human being or human society, but there are differences between the cultures of different societies and the evolution of the cultures of societies. And I do think that we have to – part of the task of a socialist revolution is to create a new culture, which will entail things like a new morality and things like that. And to the extent that we can try through our own desperate sorts of social engineering and cultural production to nudge that so emerging socialist culture, which may or may not have at some point in the near future some claim on political power and therefore spreading cultural hegemony, like, you know, push it in the direction of decency and radical democracy and actual toleration of pluralism and dissent, we have an obligation to do so. And the only way that those narratives are going to spread at all is if they actually affect people's narratives of their own lives and who they are and how they derive meaning from the world. So it's not that I disagree with you in the facts. It's that whether or not we want to do this, this is something that we're doing. And the more that we're able to openly acknowledge that, the more we can actually try to push things in the direction of at least a minimally decent outcome. You know, like, I've been told that I'm a utopian by a whole bunch of different people, like, you know, like everyone from, like, people in the petty bourgeois neighborhood of my upbringing to people who are, like, supposedly, like, you know, like these, like, hardcore Marxist materialists. You're just a utopian idealist. You think that you can engineer these structures and blah, 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 blah. But, you know, like, I'm actually, like, temperamentally really pessimistic and very minimal in my kind of, like, acceptable goals of, like, if I lived my life and it was worthwhile, it, you know, I'd nudge the world in a slightly more decent and humane direction. I'm temperamentally skeptical of, like, grand utopian projects, but you have to be able to give people, in my opinion, some way of plugging themselves as individuals and as moral individuals. And I know this is going to make the orthodox Marxists listening really cringe, but it's true. I think some way of plugging into the real movement, as Marx would have described it, because if not, If you don't give them a way of plugging in that forwards actual conceptions of, like, radical democracy and egalitarianism and pluralism as good things in and of themselves, of socialism as liberation rather than socialism as bureaucratic tyranny, then you're – and you don't give them forms of life that give them some taste of that experience on the micro level, mm-hmm. then what you're going to do is create the suicide cult, whether you want to or not, whether that was your idea of how the mechanical clanking of history's machine was going to turn out or not. Because that's part of how the machine works, is that we act on it. And we can nudge, you know, we can nudge things so that, like, this lever comes down instead of the one right next to it or something like that. So that's my, I don't know how inspirational or not that was, but that's my attempt at an inspirational speech.
Well, I mean, you know, it's funny because I think it's absolutely necessary. It's one of these things where we use idealism as an insult, and I do too. I mean, like, when I actually am bothered by idealist categorizations, but I also, in another way, think it's absolutely necessary. I mean, in a sense, if we didn't have some conception of at least what we are against and why we are against it and what negating it is for, then, and that is an ideal conception. You can't materially know what this is going to be. You can't know the contradictions. You can't know the unintended consequences. I mean, but in another sense, it is very important that we do, like, the unintended consequences that we can know, we are pretty clear about. And I think to bring it back, to tie it around to where the DSA's principle of charity can be useful. And this is where a whole lot of the Marxist-Leninist, and even some of the people who see themselves as post-Marxist-Leninist, there's, you know, the Marxist Center, which sees itself as is not Marxist-Leninist anymore, you know, but coming out of that.
I actually quite like the Marxist centrists. Somebody should write a thing about them, because they have...
There's two forms of it, and I was kind of involved with one form of it. So there's the Kautskyite form of it, and then there's the kind of post-Maoist form of it. And the post-Maoist form of it does kind of operate on similar things as to you, but a lot of what, you know, they hate the DSA.
Yes, they do. And it's funny that they do, because on a principle of convergent evolution, they're generating very similar structures, albeit much more slowly because they're a little mired in the dogmatism of Orthodox Marxism. But, like, you know, they're generating very similar structures to the ones that are being developed within DSA. So,
yeah, what's funny about that is on the Maoist side, though, they're mired in doctrine of Orthodox Marxism, but they're also right now... They have taken dual power as to mean mutual aid. So it's like dual power without the dual part. So I guess, you know, like social power as opposed to political power. Because of a hostility towards reformism, but also a realization that, you know, insurrection, starting off from an insurrectionary Marxist point of view at this point in time in history would not just be impossible. It would be dangerous. You know, and that it has generated historically since the 70s a bunch of cults. I mean, one of the things that's interesting to point out about the new SDS is it was also, you know, tied into people like one of the many Freedom Road organizations, which was plagued with rape scandals. And
is Freedom Road at this point an organization, or is it just like a brand that starts creating franchises?
There's more than it might be. I mean, the other thing is there's more than one of them, and I don't know. How
oh God, I didn't know that.
Yes, there's already two Freedom Roads, like, but there might even be three or four now, because I think one of them had issues with a rape scandal and maybe split within itself. You know, kind of like the Trotskyist organizations did just a little bit before that. And that's another thing about the DSA is going to have its number of sexual scandals, particularly as people do what you predict they're going to do with it. The moment people start using it as a community, these sorts of dynamics are going to emerge. I mean, that, and to me, we should, the thing about it is we have to deal with it transparently. We also have to deal with it realistically. Because acting like, you know, a socialist society isn't going to be plagued with the same kind... I mean, a socialist group isn't going to be plagued by some of the same bullshit that exists in a larger culture just because we're socialist is like...
Well, that itself is idealistic, I would say.
I mean, that's... But, you know. Yeah, it's extremely idealistic and dumb. We just have to... We have to be transparent about how we handle it.
May I plug a book really
quick? Yeah, go ahead.
People who are interested in avoiding... the interpersonal toxicity and the sort of catastrophic spirals that can happen, both because of these like patriarchal and rape culture type abuses, and also because of the kind of like opposite problem, which is the kind of like way in which identity politics or victimhood culture can be mobilized as a tool of authoritarianism and bullying, both of these oftentimes working together. If you want to figure out what the deal is with that and how to avoid it, one of the best books on the subject is a kind of sleeper hit in academia. It's called Conflict Is Not Abuse by Sarah Shulman. It's called Conflict Is Not Abuse. Find it, buy it, pirate it, get your hands on it, spread it to other people. It really is – it's written by somebody who's like a – anarcho-friendly, post-occupies, it seems, type kind of like anarchistish, queer, radical person who is in those kinds of circles and writes honestly and I think quite transparently and about those kinds of dynamics. And chances are that you've seen something like this. And, you know, the first step to understanding is getting out of your own conceptions of how the world works and looking at how the world actually is and how it defies those conceptions. And that this book is kind of like important for that. So Conflict Is Not Abuse. Read it. It's really I'm not being paid, I promise, for doing the ad, but I'm telling everybody that I know about it, if I can, to read the book for the exact reason that Varn just said, because this is stuff that is going to happen. If it hasn't happened to you, then you're probably overdue for it.
Yeah, I mean, one, we have real abuse scandals, and two, this is the biggest thing. Socialists, it's a thing that Doug Lane and I try to get people to think about a lot. In so much that I'm against all this eschatology talk, I also think, like, socialism isn't going to end history. It's the abolition of one, of in my mind, actually, one and only one social contradiction, and it's not, you know, like, the other ones were going to have to be worked out because there will be changed by it. I've talked about it before, like gender and race relations. Like, I actually do think there's some truth that racism emerges out of enlightenment. I don't blame it entirely on capitalism. It predates it a little bit, but it does emerge out of the enlightenment and the way we think about it. But once that genie's out of the bottle, it's not going to go away just because we get rid of capitalism. And you see this in, like, Russian Russification policies and all that, and blaming that on state capitalism seems like it's just a lie. Social chauvinism is a problem, and it's kind of a problem even in the DSA. Just gonna point that out.
Yeah, especially among the old guard, I would say.
I mean, there is a controversy, and admittedly, the controversy was mostly from DSA people, and it wasn't endorsed by the national or local. It's just a member. But it was engaging in some of, like, China scary bad.
But did you see the there was a Libertarian Socialist Caucus member, not to plug my own faction, but there was a wonderful called A.W. Winslow, who wrote in the same blog a response article to it that was absolutely fantastic, I thought.
A lot of people who didn't leave because of that article, who were like, because I knew some people who were like, if somebody doesn't censor this or at least correct it, we should leave Yorg. I think that was definitely the stance of, like, the CLT members who were also DSA members. Like, you know, no, we can't tolerate social chauvinism. And I guess maybe this is an interesting point. Maybe this is an interesting point to leave off of, and maybe we can then get to the locals and nationals really fast.
Sure.
What is the actual line? Like, where do you, as a member of the DSA, just speaking from yourself, think this is the eternal problem of pluralism. Like, we want to be pluralistic. We want the dialectic within our groups to commence by allowing diverse views and battles to take place within our groups that are safe enough not to decimate it. That's an important thing. But we also do have to have some line of, like, demarcation, because, you know, I've been criticized for being too strict on what my definitions are. And I was told, you know, vague definitions are necessary for a movement to grow. And I'm like, yeah, until you actually have to do something. And then no one can agree on what they're doing. Is the line?
Oh, God. You know, I could go on for another 2 hours on this, because there's a whole theory of assembly democracy that I could throw out right now, which I shouldn't, to explain my views of what I think the line is. I'll try to do a very tiny, tiny sliver of that whole chunk. But I'll do that after I just answer the question directly. So what is the line in DSA? The line de facto is a couple of things. The line is best understood as whatever is voted on as the law, so to speak, at the conventions that are once every 2 years. Or intermediately, anything that's voted on a locals like convention, because most of the big locals have conventions too that are constitutional and the like, you know, to adopt as an official position of that local. So on a very simple level, like, the line is sort of that. So things that have been agreed upon are that DSA is now officially for, as a national organization, Medicare for All. And actually, I was part of an initiative on the convention floor that ended up, even though that wasn't our initial goal, opening up the opportunity for my very good friend, Aaron, and I don't want to say your last name in case she doesn't want to get mentioned, who is a wonderful person in New York, who basically was able to put forward, along with some other people, language that explicitly made the Medicare for All not just a goal in itself, but the first step towards a system of socialized medicine. So now there is language that basically says that that is an official position of the national DSA, and that there is now an initiative for a Medicare for All, like, national thing that has its own national working group that plugs in with locals, and locals basically voluntarily participate in it and help, and it's like a coordinating body between locals for this specific initiative to try to push forward Medicare for All. So that's, like, one official position that has been adopted as of the last convention, which was last summer. Similarly, prison abolition is apparently now an official DSA position. It might be reversed in future conventions if there's actual opportunity to push forward action or legislation that people might not actually agree with, but it was passed. So we'll see how that persists. And then the reason why I'm being very conditional about it is, oh, one last thing. The Ackerman strategy, even though it is not has not been adopted in an official capacity, has de facto basically been the hegemonic position vis-a-vis the Democrats, although there's lots of dissent, and my guess is that attempts to either institutionalize it or reject it will probably come up at the next convention. Now, the reason...
Either one of those would be devastating to the DSA.
I actually completely agree. It's going to be an interesting, dicey convention for a whole lot of reasons, but the... Here's my take. The reason why it's important to understand the line as being a moving target is because what a line is for the DSA is not what a line is for all these, like, Bolshevik descended groups where – and I'm sorry to all the people who are going to be insulted by what I'm about to say, but this is my interpretation and, you know, like, feel free to disagree. But there is a tendency, I think, in the Leninist tradition to basically make arguments about any given political position that you have to take on any given political debate as essentially being answered by the correct reading of Das Kapital Volume 1 or the Communist Manifesto. And that reading will give you the position that is the one acceptable position, because there is one acceptable reading of a passage that will give you that truth on that position. And it is of the utmost importance for the vanguard party of the proletariat to have the correct line, which proceeds from the correct analysis, which proceeds essentially from this theological exegetical reading of the sacred texts, you know, and any diversion from that line is revisionism or deviation from the truth of Marxism itself as a system. So what that means is that the tendency is to not only have, like, a rigid, calcified line that's dictated from the top down, but also not to actually be able to change positions on anything, because you're doing a debate on positions not based on an actual materialistic analysis of the conditions on the ground, or the truth. I mean, forget the truth of how things actually stand, but, like, basically this kind of, like, theological thing where there's in an a prioristic kind of way, there is one correct interpretation of a sacred text that is assumed to have all the answers for all the potential questions. So the whole problem with thinking of DSA as having a line in that is that, like, when people talk about a line on the left, they're talking about an idea that, even if it's not quite, maybe if what I just said is a caricature, and some people will say it is, it is nevertheless, when people talk about a line on the left, they tend to be talking about something that has a family resemblance to the set of assumptions that I just outlined. And that, no matter what DSA adopts at a convention, that is not the conception of a collective political position that exists within the org. it might be the kind of thing that certain individuals in the org want to move the org towards, especially people who self-identify as centralists in the kind of like small communist minority of the sort that I was telling you about last episode. But, you know, it's really not. I mean, like, and in terms of then what a line is, this is actually something that I think has to be theorized. And I don't want to get into the whole theory of it, but like, if a line, I'll just say this, if a line is not something which can change and is not something that you can dissent from even after it has been decided upon publicly.
Mm-hmm. This is a thing that is true for all versions of Leninism, including ones that aren't in the ML or even the L tradition, for those who don't speak our weird anachronisms, the Marxist-Leninist or the Leninist tradition, because Bordigas considered the line invariant to the point of being transhistorical.
Yes, and which is insane. I mean, I actually think that Bordiga is probably the most precise reader of certain books of Lenin's, and he's probably like close to the theoretical positions that are outlined there.
And more consistent than Lenin is, honestly.
Yeah, exactly. Like, Bordiga's really good to read because he is essentially a reductio ad absurdum argument against Leninism itself.
Even though he really believes it.
Oh, he believes it. Well, that's exactly why he's a great argument against it, because look at what happens if you believe it. You become Bordiga in his armchair.
As a side note, I actually do think the Bordiga's problem is interesting in so much that Bordiga's main historical point was for absolute ethnic and cultural and even tendency pluralism within the Comintern. And so his invariance later to me does seem like he doesn't see it as conflicting, but it does seem to be obviously conflicting.
Yeah, I was gonna say it's like that seems a little hard to reconcile.
He is the man who told Stalin that every national party should have equal weight and vote in the Comintern.
That's nice.
Called him the grave digger of the revolution to his face. And is the only person who got away with it.
Like, yeah, I was gonna say how do you not get his ass purged?
Fascism happened in Italy, so the Comintern couldn't get to him.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, lucky Bordiga. Anyway, my point is just, you know, that's not even the conception of a line that exists within DSA de facto. Now, what conception of a line exists in DSA is difficult to describe because it has not been theorized. So this is actually something that needs to be done. If you're a DSA and you're listening to this, one of the things that you can do if you're listening to this conversation and you find that it accords to your experience is we actually need to start writing a lot of this stuff down. And even if we're wrong, even if we don't get the whole story right at first, even if people disagree with you, you have to start, if you have the skills that it takes to theorize this, like actually start thinking through like in Marxist terms or whatever political theoretical terms you use to make sense of the world, what is going on in DSA right now? What is going on in the contemporary moment right now? We need new theories for it, because that's actually a good deal of how we can actually like act in the world knowingly and with some amount of control over our circumstances. I don't know exactly. My hypothesis is that the DSA is creating essentially, without knowing it and unconsciously, a new conception of political consensus within a radical left organization that is anti-Leninist. Now, whether or not that will actually calcify itself into a viable alternative has yet to be demonstrated. But the germ of it, at least, exists in things like the civility norms, which guarantee pluralism. What are the obstacles to it? I would say that there's a couple. One would be a reversion to previous dogmas, because obviously since you have a whole lot of people who are becoming more radical socialists, the first thing that they do is that they read up on radical socialist theory from the past, and they might turn those into sacred texts, and then we're just back down the Maoist Stalinoid rabbit hole again. A second obstacle is, I think, the kind of new constellation of bad authoritarian habits from the kind of like identity politics, identitarian sector. Now, I'm not an enemy of identity politics in the sense of liberation struggles on behalf of, you know, specific ethnic groups, racial groups, gender, sexuality.
You're not a class like, only Marxist or whatever.
Quite to the contrary. Part of the reason I began to self-identify as an anarchist was precisely that there were obviously, trivially obviously, other forms of oppression and hierarchy that didn't directly have to do with capitalism.
Right. Which is, I get really mad at Marxists who try to play the whole, well, it's all really capitalism because patriarchy and racism are also really created by capitalism. I'm just like, no, they're not.
No, it's like, that's objectively not true. Like, yeah. Like, I mean, feudal society was patriarchal. Like, it's like, sorry, that's true.
Yeah, I mean, like yes, and modern racism aside, ethnocentrism and xenophobia are way older than race.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that there's a so I'm not one of these people, but it unfortunately is a truth not acknowledged by enough people on the left that within the movements for struggles for liberation, on racial grounds, on queer grounds, on whatever, feminist grounds, there have been tendencies within those movements that are authoritarian, even approximating totalitarian in their attempt to, like, you know, do groupthink and thought control as, like, these enforced kind of practices, and, like, that can be really toxic. And to deny that is to deny reality, because if you go into certain left-wing activist circles or you go into Left Book or something, you see it. You see the consequences of it. And, you know, you guys published Angela Nagel's Kill All Normies, which got a lot of flack for being one of the first books to talk about this. But it listed a whole bunch of concrete examples of this kind of stuff. And as I noted in my review for In These Times. And similarly, the Sarah Schulman book, Conflict Is Not Abuse, that I was talking about before, also lists a whole bunch of examples. And there's another book called So You've Been Publicly Shamed or something like that, which also has a whole bunch of examples of this. So my point is just to say that, like, that ideology, the not like identity politics in the broad sense that I'm a part of and I said, but in the narrow sense of these kinds of, like, censorious authoritarian practices that believe that free speech is basically like a white cis male bourgeois illusion, and that, like, the censorship or public humiliation or, like, you know, viable ways and shunning or, like, viable ways of policing correct behavior in our circles and in society at large, that tendency is itself also a threat to the creation of this kind of, like, pluralistic radical democratic alternative to Leninism that I think DSA is in the process of inventing. And it's especially a threat in as much as it's weaponized by the new generation of Stalinists in order to delegitimize those experiments in radical democracy that exist within the DSA by saying, well, all this sentimental attachment to things like pluralism and free speech is just because, like, it's a bunch of, like, petty bourgeois, white, upper-middle-class people. You know,
right,
like,
although
real...
that's normally who a lot of these Stalinists are, too.
Well, right. I mean, like, not forgetting the fact that half of these Twitter anime Stalinists are themselves also, like, downwardly mobile petty bourgeois people. And also, I mean, like, I would even go further than that. I mean, like, the Party of Socialism and Liberation is kind of, like, rebranded to supposedly be, like, all the woke people of color. And a lot of their spokespeople are, of course, like, you know, Latino or black. But the interesting thing is that, first of all, this is a very recent transformation, and the founders and the head cadre are, as far as I understand, still basically the same people who they were, you know, 10 years ago, when they were just a bunch of old white dudes.
You saw and similar things in the RCP, too. But yeah, go
and
ahead.
And the second thing is, I mean, these are cadre organizations that literally in a certain city that I know, they literally recruit from, like, a gym that they have because some rich member is able to own real estate or whatever, and they recruit people through that. You know, like they have, like, this, like, heavy screening membership period that, like, takes forever to be a part of. They have strict ideological rigid unity, which, of course, when you have that kind of, like, invariant line, what ends up happening is that you end up having splits and purges, right? So, like, if we're being honest, even if, as has been rumored and that I've heard, and I don't have this in print, but I have it on good authority that there are at least certain PSL chapters that are literally through this screening process refusing anybody who's a white male in order to jump up their quota numbers so that they can have this kind of, like, you know, position of authority on identitarian grounds. Even if they're doing that, I bet you anything that Leninism is such as a failed organizing method that there are more people of color in DSA than there are the entire membership, white and black and whatever, in PSL. I bet you anything. And if the PSL people want to prove me wrong, I officially challenge them to release their actual membership demographic numbers to the world, which of course they won't because they're like the secret sect.
Right, I was about to say, none of these sects will. I mean, having been involved in some of these things, like, it's forbidden to do so. And what's weird, though, that's not just unique to ML organizations or Stalinists. I want, this is where I'm going to help you out, but I want to point it out, too. Left communist organizations do this. I even know some Marxist humanist organizations who are so paranoid about their membership that they don't even let membership out each other's name to other membership.
Exactly.
Like...
And it's like, I mean, that's – and also helps information control by the Central Committee also, of course, helps consolidate authoritarian power.
And, like, transparency. That's not unique to democratic centralist organizations. They're organizations who supposedly are completely opposed to it who operate the exact same way.
True. Although I do think that it ends up being authoritarian anyway because controls the information flow, basically, you know.
These have become cults of personality with single person dominant, even though these same people. Well, I'm just pointing it out that the ML structure is not the only structure that does exactly this very thing. You could on paper be opposed to all this and sound like on paper completely opposed to vanguardism and all that, and still effectively be doing the same thing, or in some cases even worse.
So just to get back to DSA, that's a lot of this, I think, exists in like the ridiculous fringe right now, but it could be used in order to destroy the DSA entirely.
And there are people who are. I mean, I mentioned two groups last week, and I mentioned them in another show. Actually, a show comes out of Portland called "Give Me the Wrong Person, Mike." But I mentioned two groups that I like that are members that have encouraged dual entryism into the DSA, the Communist League of Tampa, and the not Maoist elements of the Marxist Center. They're of a different, even though they're always complaining about DSA reformism, but there are at least some kind of post leftcom Marxist Centerist groups who have encouraged that. But they're not the only, and I mention them because I know them and I know it for a fact, and I don't feel like I'm outing anyone. even though they're kind of Kautskyist, so there is some version of democratic centralism going on there, but it's a very mild version, and I think they would even agree with the statement I made about democratic centralism is redundant. You know, like it's really just democracy. However, We both know that there are plenty of groups already doing this with the DSA who see it as a shell. And, you know, Marxist-Leninist groups, even though they're technically not supposed to join, left-com groups, communizing groups even, which is, to me, really weird, have all entered the DSA recently. How does the DSA handle that? Like this is where the national-local tension, I think, is going to be where we can pivot to that and really talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, the way that it handles it is essentially by being itself. I know that sounds kind of like tautological, but I mean, the way that DSA handles it is by being what DSA was. Because remember, this culture that I'm talking about that emerged, like, you know, unintentionally. And I don't want to, by the way, make it seem like all of it comes from the civility norms. Like I just
right,
using
the civility norms are also like, I mean, even though they're old by left standards, they're still kind of late for the DSA because they would have come in the 2000s. Like they're still
exactly
Bush era stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, like, and there's also other things that emerged. I'm just using the civility norms as one example among many of this kind of emergent culture. But this culture that is developing within the DSA gives it resilience because there actually is DSA group identity as DSA and DSA kind of like morality as a DSAer, where like, sure, you can be a person who comes in, but if you start like trying to publicly denounce people in like a kind of like show trial or struggle session, people will just not want to deal with you.
I happen to know for a fact, though, this does happen in locals who don't know how to set up their civility norms, even if they have them.
And this is where the battle to maintain DSA as what it is in its sort of like historic role, if you want to be really kind of highfalutin about it, is going to be like the big struggle. Because to the extent that we can give people the tools, we as in members within the DSA who care about it remaining internally democratic and pluralistic and having this kind of like generation of new kinds of socialism, new kinds of ideas, to the extent that we can actually keep this stuff at bay by basically reinforcing the stuff that already exists and just helping people to acculturate to it and essentially quarantining and marginalizing those who would try to subvert it, not, again, by subvert like labeling them as subversives and excluding them so much as just through making it so that the process is set up in such a way that they can't really fuck with it. Even if they try, they'll just make themselves ridiculous. To the extent that we succeed at doing that, then we have some hope of being able to become what it is I think that DSA has the potential to become. If we can't do that, then the chances are that one or the other of these types of cults or authoritarian ideologies will – I don't think that they'll take over the DSA. The DSA is too big to take over except through the democratic process that has been established to get people in the MPC, and the MPC can't even really control the locals, which we can get into if as a transition. But just to finish the thought, like probably what a group like that could do is do what the Parliamentary Labour Party did to SDS, which is to force such a high-stress fissure that forces everyone to take sides that the thing can fall apart. And the only way that you build resilience to that is by basically doubling down on the idea, and not just like as a norm, but as a set of like processes for arriving at decisions, that we may believe different things, but at the end of the day, we're all socialists in the big tent of socialism that fundamentally sees socialism as radical democracy. Like, what makes a DSA or a DSA is that we're all socialists of different kinds who all agree that you can't have socialism without socialism being civil rights, free speech, whatever. Like, the extension of those things and of the successes of liberal democracy into the economy so that liberal democracy is not rendered essentially a farce and a hypocritical kind of nonsense like it is under capitalism, but actually, like, is like the core truth that was always inside it actually gets realized. Now, that is not yet, to answer your question about the line, that's not yet part of the line, but it's part of the culture, and it's the strongest part of the culture. It's the part of the culture that gives me any kind of hope, and to the extent that we can institutionalize it, that's where we'll succeed. And to the extent that we fail to do this is where the vultures will come in and pick at our corpse. And that's really where it is. So do you want to get to the I'm sorry, we've gone on so many philosophical digressions. I want to get to the national versus local.
Yeah, so let's take a brief break.